the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was a son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Rev and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I've come up with a solution. You know, sometimes we're afraid people are not going to read the Bible. They're not going to bother to look at it. I have an idea. Let's put the word classified or classified information on the cover, and all of a sudden people will take the Bible home. They're going to open it. They're going to read it. Well, the word classified, right? Everybody wants to obtain that information.
You're taking a story out of the Bible. There was one tree. It was classified. They couldn't touch it. Right. And you'd say, when you tell us we can't have something, we want it even more.
Exactly.
Human nature.
Yeah. I was telling people, I can't get toothpaste out of the cabinet in the drugstore. They can get classified documents out of the White House.
Other places. Rabbi is on. He's starting out the gate. Full force this Sunday morning.
Anyway,
welcome. Yeah, welcome our audience to the Rev and the Rabbi here. Right.
This past week, obviously, the funeral. Tyre Nichols.
Yeah.
Center stage. Everybody paid attention. There was a collective anger.
Mm-hmm.
Right? With the Floyd horror. People on different sides of the aisle, people who may not be so emotionally charged in other settings, this got to them.
Yeah.
There was something here that said, this is so offensive, I can't remain silent.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I, like I said, you know, we talked about, a little bit about this last week. I talked about the anger, the confusion, and the tears that were shed. And it continues because as things unfold, you know, we find that there are more people involved and they're taking swift action. But unfortunately, Rabbi, and I don't want to be negative, but we've seen a pattern that moral outrage doesn't always immediately convert to political action.
Right.
We've seen, outrageous shootings.
Right. Fleeting outrage.
Exactly. Fleeting. Yeah. And to convert that to political action where we actually put policy in place and changes, you know, that's where the fight and the time goes into play. They've got this George Floyd bill, and the George Floyd bill that's being pushed by the Biden administration. And I want to be careful not to oversimplify, but to summarize it, takes a look at things like the standard for criminal intent when a police officer, you know, either fails to do their duty or, you know, exercises aggressive force or violence or even perpetrates death. They're also looking at limiting the it's qualified immunity because, you know, police officers get protected as a result, as I say. So
training.
So it takes time. Yeah. So we experience a moral outrage, the funerals and the aftermath and the protests. And thank God that, you know, things were pretty calm across the country and here in our city. But still, it doesn't immediately translate into some change in policy.
I remember reading a discussion that took place among some theologians about what was the most important passage in the Bible. And, you know, everybody had their own affirmation of belief in God. And someone said, and it was the day after. Those are the most important words.
Yeah.
Because it's what we do the day after that determines were we really serious about, you know, what happened the day before. Look, there are times when people can disagree on the George Floyd bill, certain parts of it. So find the parts that we agree on. You know, let's not reject everything in toto.
Yeah.
There's a place, you know, where we can find some, you know, sense of agreement. But you're right. I remember 9/11. Remember how this country, we're together. How long did that last? You know, how long did that last? We're very good at that momentary, you know, emotion, But the day after, it dissipates.
We're back to we go back to our corners. Yeah. It's almost a double-edged sword because here in New York, if there's ever a city that comes together in a time of crisis, New York has that history. New York has that reputation that we come together, you know. But then after the crisis is over, you know, we go back to our enclaves, unfortunately.
You know, Rabbi Haskell Lukstein is a great rabbi here in New York City, Kehilath Jeshurun on the east side. He wrote a book entitled Where We Are Brothers Keepers. And he goes back to looking at newspapers during the Holocaust, newspapers in America. And he said, here they have these horrific killings, the slaughter going on. And you picked up the paper, and there were sales in stores and the barbecues. You know, they kept murdering, and we kept, you know, going on with our regular lifestyle. Yeah. And you say, you know, there was a march here and there. There was a concerted effort here and there, but overall, life went on.
Well, you know how I respond to things like that? When you're watching the news, right, and there is a crisis, maybe even a murder or something, in a community that, you know, murders are every 40 years. But the person says, I never expected that to happen in my community.
Right.
It's not until it comes home to your community, to your family, to your personal life, that all of a sudden you feel the need to get involved. But when you feel that you're distanced, that you're separated from all that's going on the news, right, you go on about your business, Rabbi.
Yeah.
So until it becomes personal, we don't get involved.
Isn't it true that in our religious arena, all of life is personal?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It's not just about me. It's also my relationship with you. And you can't close your eyes, you know, and just say, well, it happened there, but it's not going to happen here. It's their problem, not my problem. Religious people don't say that.
Yeah.
It's always our problem.
What Dr. King called a bond of mutuality, where we have so much in common. We're connected to each other, no matter how different we may be. And that's true. That's a reality, Rabbi.
And, you know, during COVID, when we'd all stand out there and applaud the healthcare professionals, we said, you are our heroes because you saved lives of people who are different from one another because you saw them all as human family.
Yeah. And human person.
Yeah.
Life and dignity of a human person. We got a guest.
We got a good guest today. Mm-hmm. All of our guests have been superb so far. Mark Levine.
Yeah.
You and I have known him for some time. He's on the city council. He's now president of the borough of Manhattan. And I find him to be someone who's a thinker and a doer. So look forward to that discussion. There are many issues. Let's see if we can try to make a difference.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more of the Reverend the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, you and I have been privileged to know Mark Levine, who's now president of the borough of Manhattan. For some time, we've known him. I remember when he was on the city council. He certainly represents Washington Heights very well when he was with the city council. I lived in Washington Heights. I went to school in Washington Heights, college. Some of the greats came out of Washington Heights. Am I right, President Levine?
Oh, my goodness. We've had opera singers. We've had secretaries of state, major baseball players. I'll never live up to that standard, but no doubt about it. We've got some famous alumni from Uptown.
But you notice he said the greats came out of Washington Heights after he said, I came out of Washington Heights.
No.
He says, I don't make you. No,
you got to listen to Rabbi Potasnik carefully, okay?
I'm a humble public servant, nothing more.
And much to be humble about, as Churchill would say. So there is a lot to talk about today. First of all, you gave a state of the borough. the other night, and I know that was well received. But before we get into that, there's an issue that's being discussed. You had a press conference last week about the Canyon of Heroes. Talk about that.
Yes, Rabbi. We joined with representatives of the World Jewish Congress to point out something I think a lot of your listeners will be shocked to hear. Among the names on Lower Broadway honored in the Canyon of Heroes are two men who went on to become prominent collaborators in the Nazi regime in France. Pierre Laval and Henri Pétain went on to become the head of government and the prime minister during a Nazi regime in France that deported 75,000 Jews, most of whom were murdered in concentration camps. Those two names are emblazoned on the sidewalk of Lower Manhattan on Broadway, right near the Bull. And we have called for them to be removed. We gathered on the occasion of International Holocaust Remembrance Day last Friday. We're getting nothing but strong support in the days since.
Mark, there was a press conference that you held last week talking about something that I found to be almost impossible to believe. Talk about it.
I think a lot of your listeners would be shocked to know that there are two names emblazoned in the Canyon of Heroes, names with plaques on Broadway, names of two men who went on to become major figures in the Nazi regime in France. This is Henri Pétain and Pierre Laval, who were the prime minister and head of state during the Nazi regime in France, a regime that deported 75,000 Jews, most of whom were murdered in concentration camps. They're villains of history. There's no ambiguity on that. But their names are still given a place of honor on Lower Broadway. So we joined with leaders last Friday, including the World Jewish Congress, to demand the removal of those plaques.
They were Frenchmen, right? Why were they there in the first place?
Yes. So they had been prominent military leaders in World War I for France and were hailed as heroes. They were honored with ticker tape parades in Broadway in 1930 and 1931 and were given that respect because of their leadership in World War I. Of course, they later went on to be villainous leaders in World War II. But here's what's shocking. The plaques were not put down until 2004. So even at that time, they were well known for 60 years for having been Nazi collaborators. Their names had long been removed from streets and monuments all over France. They were actually tried and convicted of treason in France. But even at that time, as late as 2004, somehow they went ahead with including their names on the Canyon of Heroes. So it really is unacceptable that they would continue to hold a place of honor in our city. And that's why we called for the removal of those plaques.
You know, I had a discussion with Menachem Rosensaft, who was at your press conference. He's with the World Jewish Congress. And I said, you know, Menachem, we live in a climate where we're discussing whether a statue should be there or not there.
Yep.
And now you have, you know, this issue. He said, there's a great distinction. These two people were found guilty by France. One was executed. One died in prison. He said, I have no problem with removing the names of people who committed these heinous acts. And I agree. I mean, there's no justification for those names to be there.
I agree as well. And look, there's lots of complicated questions in the topic of revisiting monuments, and there are gray areas. But I think we can all agree on one thing, that major Nazi collaborators are not a gray area. This is one thing that there should be consensus on. There's really no justification for them receiving any place of honor. Again, this is a settled matter in France. It was settled decades ago. It should be settled here in New York as well.
That's a tough one because as a person of color, of course, you know, I'm going to look at the African-American experience here. And, you know, collaborators for slavery, you know, they were in abundance and enshrined in American history in statues and memorials across the country. Do we now begin to investigate these? Do we deal with them as they come up? You know, how do we apply that? We're still working through as a nation, whereas the Holocaust took place, you know, off of American shores and was not really integrated into American society, even though you still did experience, you know, discrimination here. Where do we draw the line on things like this?
Well, I think that the reconsideration of the historic figures who we honor through monuments is really important and long overdue and can lead to a much more nuanced understanding of these figures. There's been a recent wave of removal of people who were leaders of the Confederacy in a civil war that was fought by the South in large part to defend the heinous institution of slavery. And I certainly strongly supported the removal of those monuments. And this work is ongoing. It's ongoing nationally in New York City. And I think it's a healthy debate. And sometimes the questions are tough. But I do think in the case of Nazi collaborators and as well as people who fought to maintain slavery in the South, that there really is no gray area and that these are not individuals who deserve any place of honor in our current society.
But do we keep them in a textbook? Because I want to know the stories of these individuals.
Well, that's where historical context,
yeah,
you know, becomes critical. I think one of the things we don't do well is tell, you know, Paul Harvey, when he was on the air, used to say, and now you know the rest of the story.
The rest of the story, yeah.
And I think in many cases, people don't know the rest of the story. So they know about World War I, as Mark said, but they don't know about World War II. Hmm. Or they know two and they don't know one. We don't do a very good job of teaching history in it. Studies have shown that a lot of our people graduating schools are really not well informed when it comes to U.S. history.
Do we keep them in a textbook, Mark? Where do we tell the story?
Absolutely, these stories must be told, and the rabbi's right. Like we failed to teach this history. We failed to teach African American history adequately. It's appalling that the College Board is eliminating, as you probably saw this week, the AP Black History test.
Mm-hmm.
That's indefensible. It's also appalling that surveys of young Americans show shocking ignorance of the Holocaust, that a majority of young adults can't name even one concentration camp. So we have failed to teach that history as well. We don't need to shy away from the tough topics. On the contrary, we need to confront them directly. But there's also a conversation about who deserves to be honored. Hmm. And I think we're talking about two groups of people, those who fought to uphold the institution of slavery, and those who collaborated with mass murder of Jews in Europe in World War II. In those cases, there really is no question. These folks should not be honored, and that's why we spoke out about the Kennedy heroes.
Is the consensus in your favor, Mark, from the community here in New York City?
I think that in the Jewish community, there's a range of opinions, but that overwhelmingly, I think people support the removal. Hmm. I think in the broader world of historians and people who are reconsidering history, there's a lot of angst right now about just how to organize this debate. And that would even extend to figures like Laval and Petain. So, but to me, there should be no debate. These two are clearly across the line.
So the question I ask is this. You have to have a minimal knowledge of history. I mean, I would think that even if you don't know much, you should know that these were Nazi collaborators. How do they ever get into the canyon? 2004, you said.
It is shocking. It's shocking that at that point, 60 years after the events of World War II, that happened. And I don't know. But they've been there for almost two decades. Mm. And that's too long. It's time to correct that.
Reverend, you and I have had a discussion about moral education. We talk about moral values. And, Mark, I think there is something missing in that school curriculum. Where do young people learn to differentiate between right and wrong? I mean, when I see some of the criminal acts being perpetrated by young people, young kids, say to yourself, don't they know this is the wrong thing to do? And maybe we're missing something in the school. If they're not getting it at home and they're only getting it in social media or with friends, then we need to be very, very present in that school setting with the curriculum.
Yes, certainly the teaching of ethics and civics and also history from a perspective of teaching us important moral lessons is really important. And I don't think we're doing enough on any of those fronts. And probably that's why we have such and part of one of the reasons we have such a toxic discourse now on social media and elsewhere. And yes, schools could really help to give people, young people, the tools to engage more thoughtfully and constructively in the public discourse.
And it's unfortunate because we've gotten to a place over the last two decades where when you talk about character curriculum, character development, moral curriculum, moral development, it's immediately relegated to religion, and we've got to have this separation of church and state. So we don't want that in our educational system. But that's a problem. It was Teddy Roosevelt who said to educate a man in mind and not in morals is to educate a menace to society. So, you know, morality is important. There are just certain things that science cannot explain in terms of the totality of the human person. And morality comes into play. We have this sense of right and wrong, feelings of guilt if we offend someone, even if we have not, even if we don't know the Ten Commandments, we still have this conscience that condemns us, that judges our actions.
Some do.
Yeah. Well, no, I think we can ignore it, but I think it's present in everyone. This sense of, oh, I may have stepped over a line. They may not understand it, be able to, you know, to clearly articulate the philosophy behind it. What do you think, Mark?
Well, sure. Grappling with the great text of history, both secular and religious, is extremely important for understanding the human condition. You want to tap a great diversity of traditions. You don't only want to tap the Protestant, Christian, European canon. You want to diversify in every way. But there's so much to learn in that rich heritage, and I do feel that we're not doing enough to pass those treasures on to the next generation.
How about if we had the commandments being taught? Not the first four. Let's go with honor parents, and there'll be a discussion about that. But let's go 6 through 10. Don't steal, don't lie, all the other things. What do you think?
Can we have
consensus there?
Sure. I mean, those are basic human values that I think are beyond dispute. And I would hope that society and communities at home and in educational institutions would instill the basic notion that one should treat others as one wish to be treated themselves.
Right.
That's a golden rule that appears in traditions and religions across humanity. And it's a great way to summarize an ethical way of living life.
Now, you see, he quoted from the New Testament, right? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. I just want you to understand that. Well, you know what it is? Until it's convenient. We have this part of America, this segment of our society, who's pushing back against commandments. I don't want to be told what to do.
The 10 suggestions.
Ted Koppel. You know, but it's a story of the school in Texas that there was protest against the commandments in the school, and they took them down. And all of a sudden, theft went up. So now they wanted to post, thou shalt not steal.
I think someone took the tablets, too.
Until we need them, until it's convenient for us, we don't want to be told what to do. We don't want to be commanded.
Yeah. Mark, let's go to a few other things. Obviously, you know, borough president, you have to grapple with many of the troubling issues of the day. Crime. People are afraid, in many cases, to go out at night. Some afraid to go out during the day. What do you say? How do you address the issue?
Well, first we have to acknowledge that there really is fear out there. The public feels it. We have to take it seriously. We also have to look at the data, which does tell a more nuanced and maybe hopeful story. In the last 60 or 90 days, we started to see some of the numbers, maybe even most of them, moving in the right direction. Subway crime has been dropping for the last couple of months. Most major categories of crime have been dropping for the last couple of months. We have a long way to go, and the fear you describe, Rabbi, is real. And look, this is a multi-front policy effort to address it. Yes, for sure, policing is part of it, but it has to be policing which is accountable and fair and not racially disproportionate. But that can't be the end of the story. We need to invest in after-school programs and youth development programs and job training programs, which which are proven to help people, young people, get on a better path. We also have to address interlocking challenges of serious mental health in a broken mental health system where we've lost hundreds of inpatient psychiatric beds in New York City, specifically in Manhattan. We need to invest more in outpatient community health programs. We have to do more to solve the human tragedy that is homelessness. Ultimately, that is a housing problem, and our failure to produce enough deeply affordable housing can be directly linked to the homelessness crisis. So we've got to work on all fronts. It's all connected. And investing in healthier societies and communities will ultimately make us safer. It's not quick. It's not easy, but we have no choice but to act.
Those things are very practical to make us safer. But people are saying, I don't feel safe. How do we respond to that whole idea of I don't feel it? Because, you know what I mean, we're doing everything. Crime is coming down. All of these realities are there. But how do we deal with that feeling that we're not safe? Do they have to see more police officers on the street? I mean, how do we respond to that?
You said before.
That feeling. That
perception.
Yeah.
Perception.
Yeah, very powerful. Yeah.
Well, first of all, we have to acknowledge that that the perception matters, and that if people feel unsafe, that is a problem for New York City, because it's going to mean we're going to have a harder time bringing people back to work, mm-hmm. to see a show, to want to visit, to go to a restaurant. So we have to deal with the perception. I think the way leaders talk about the problem is important. We have to both acknowledge the challenge and also tout our progress. We have to give people confidence that we have a plan to address these issues. And there's also secondary things we can act on that just improve the feel on the street, whether it's better lighting, removing graffiti, better sanitation, greener, more people-centered streetscapes. All these things can contribute to a feeling of health and ultimately safety on the street. Police community relations are also critical. Mm-hmm. I hear all the time that people miss the days when they got to know personally the officer on the beat. When you have those relations, conflict is less likely to escalate. You can diffuse problems early. People get to know each other on a first name basis. It prevents distrust. So the kind of community based law enforcement that is fair, that avoids escalation, is something that I hear demand for all over Manhattan.
Would you say that Manhattan has a unique set of problems compared to the other boroughs?
Yes, in every way. You can go down the list. Our challenges in housing are arguably more severe than anywhere else because cost of rents here are soaring. Our challenges on transportation, where congestion is at unprecedented levels. This is a borough that relies on mass transit more than any other. Mm-hmm. Whether the issue is parks or air quality, Manhattan has a unique perspective. It's why it's important there's a borough president's office for each of the five boroughs, because really you do need someone whose job it is every morning to get up and fight for the unique issues that our borough faces. And this is why we did a State of the Borough speech on Tuesday night, a chance to talk about where we are in Manhattan, how far we've come in the past year, what the challenges are ahead, always from the unique perspective to this amazing little island at the center of the world.
You know, Mark, since I've known you, I've always admired your ability to navigate through different neighborhoods. You're fluent in English and Spanish. I've heard your Hebrew, which is pretty good. And yet, you know, we're seeing this increase in hate crimes, and we've introduced all kinds of programs. The Rev and I have been involved in, you know, dialogue and trialogue and trying to be present. But yet we're not reaching the people who are committing the hateful acts, and especially the young people who are the perpetrators.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot to this question, Rabbi. And first, let's acknowledge that there has been an alarming rise in hate crimes. that has left pretty much no community of the city untouched. Mm-hmm. But we are particularly concerned about the rise of anti-Asian hate, the rise of anti-Semitism, increasing hatred directed towards the LGBTQ community, and, of course, ongoing stress and trauma inflicted upon Black Americans, which was highlighted quite painfully yesterday with the funeral of Tyre Nichols. Mm. Some of this is an education failure. I do think there is a connection between our failure to teach the history of all of these different groups, our failure to teach what happens when hatred escalates, when we don't teach enough about the moral failings of the past, and whether it is in slavery or segregation or the Holocaust. But there's other factors as well. There's, you know, many of the people committing the violent hate crimes, specifically those that are physical assaults in New York City, have also been people suffering with severe mental illness. So our conversation about doing better to fix a broken mental health system is directly related to addressing hate crimes. But one does have to ask themselves, okay, a person has a mental health problem. Why is it that they have absorbed this idea that they should attack an Asian American New Yorker or a Jewish New Yorker? And, you know, I think you have to look at society and what's out there in the dialogue. They're absorbing that from somewhere. And therefore, even in the case of someone who's suffering from mental illness, I think you can really indict the broader society, the dialogue on social media, on cable news, among some political leaders, and say that we have normalized hatred. And inevitably, that goes from merely hate speech to a violent attack. And we're seeing it again, painfully, in New York City.
And you wonder what's going on in the home.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
What are they exposed to when they are at home? What's being said?
He brought out a very important point, and it can't be missed. You know, we look at mental health, but can we blame mental health when someone takes the time to specifically target an Asian or a Jew? You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. How much of the mental health goes in that process of distinguishing one target from another?
It becomes too much of a defense.
Yeah, that's a very important question that he raises the question by his comment, Mark. Because, yeah, can we blame mental health when these are targeted attacks on individuals? Crimes, as you know, are crimes of opportunity and proximity. But when they specifically target and take the time, like the mass shootings, where you drive from one state all the way up to Buffalo.
Yeah, you make all,
you know what I mean?
All the preparation.
Exactly.
Right? You know exactly what
premeditation,
to do.
Sure.
So, Mark, looking ahead, what do you see as some of the things that you've noticed significant improvement? And what are some of the challenges you have to confront? Some you've mentioned already.
Well, there are all sorts of signs of Manhattan and New York City coming back. Little known fact, Manhattan's population is increasing. We're up almost 4% since pre-pandemic, which is really a great vindication of the fact that people still want to be here because of all our unique offerings. But at the same time, I'm worried that we're going to recreate some of the inequality which we saw so painfully before and during the pandemic. Specifically, I've been focusing on the affordability crisis, the lack of affordable housing. In Manhattan, average rents now in market rate apartments have exceeded $5,000 per month.
Wow.
This is unprecedented. And it means that it's not just low income people who are being priced out. And for them, of course, it's devastating and it's contributing to homelessness. But it's even working class and middle class people, bus drivers, nurses, teachers that can't afford an apartment in Manhattan. It's becoming a borough where you have to be wealthy to rent. And that's not acceptable. So we launched a major plan on Tuesday to call for creation of new housing and especially affordable housing in every neighborhood of the borough. We identified 171 sites where we can build the housing that we need, much of it at deep levels of affordability. We identified 9 neighborhoods all over the borough where we can update the zoning to unlock creating thousands of apartments so that people can stay, so that young people who have grown up in Manhattan have a chance of actually getting their own apartment here one day. But it is a crisis that we must address. It was really the focus of my State of the Borough speech on Tuesday, and it's going to be my top priority for the year ahead.
Yeah, someone would wonder, you identified 125 or 175 sites?
171
sites. And yeah. You say, well, in Manhattan, where is the land to build affordable housing? Or are we talking building up? You know, because here, air rights is a big deal in our city. Are you building up or building out?
Some, but there, you know, when we surveyed every block of the borough, we found a lot more opportunities than I would have ever expected. Some of these are vacant lots. Hmm. Some are used as surface parking. Some are single-story retail that we could build housing on top of. There's also a lot of partially empty or underutilized or outdated buildings. There's manufacturing areas that are out of date. There's an empty bus depot and other city assets that really are underutilized. There's a lot more opportunity in Manhattan than I would have expected. And we wanted to definitively make the point that, yes, there is room to build in this borough, despite what people might think, and that we have an obligation to do this because the crisis is real.
Developers are looking at houses of worship and their air rights because, you know, they have valuable land and some of them, you know, are struggling to make ends meet. So it becomes very attractive to engage in development, building up. Is that good or is that a problem here in the city?
It can be good. It can be a win-win if what emerges can save a struggling congregation and give them a wonderful modern sanctuary and also create housing that we desperately need, especially if we can get affordable housing. And we've seen projects like that in Manhattan. But it can also lead to unfortunate results. We've seen too many cases where congregations have been taken advantage of by unscrupulous developers because the congregations aren't in the real estate business. And so they're not expected to have expertise on the finances of housing, et cetera. Yeah. And of course, I care so much about the historic built legacy of the borough. And sometimes I've felt that not enough has been done to save historic churches, to find innovative ways to do that, to tap new revenue streams to pay for upkeep. We know it's very expensive to maintain an old historic building. So I think it's a topic which needs more attention. One thing that's key is we need to empower congregations to be able to navigate this, to negotiate, to be well-informed with developers who present them propositions so that none are taken advantage of in the way we've seen too often in the past.
You know, Mark, I came here from Boston, and I still have a great love for Boston, but I have to say I've become acculturated to New York, and I have witnessed over the years a passion of love for this city where people will complain, but they're not the ones I know. They want to be here.
Yeah.
And in other words, nevertheless, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to fight to make it better. I'm not walking away from a city that means so much to me. There are those who have left, but as you say, there are many people coming in, and the people I know, and Rev and I have spoken about this, we love this city. And again, I'm an outsider in that sense, but that was years ago when I came from Boston. I'm not going back there. I'm staying here. So there is much to appreciate, but there's also much to improve. And only by working together, as you have tried to do, Mark, over the years, you are a consensus builder, a bridge builder, and we're very privileged to know you.
That's a beautiful and uplifting statement, Rabbi. I agree with every word you said.
Especially about you.
Thank you. That piece. I also don't root for the Boston Red Sox.
Well, I was going to weigh in on that because he's talking about how much he loves New York, but he still roots for the Sox and the Patriots. So we get into it about that.
Yeah, but in my lifetime, I'll never see the Empire State Building have the Boston Red Sox colors.
Oh, here we go.
That's your world.
Eagles unite.
We're working on legislation to rein in that outrage.
Buenos dias, muchacho.
Muchísimas gracias. Thank you so much. Toda raba.
Bendiciones.
Bendiciones. Thank you,
Bob. All right, thank you.
President of the Borough of Manhattan.
And stay tuned for more of The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Betasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Betasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Rev, I want to use a biblical reference here. Moses appears before Pharaoh, performs some magical feats. A staff turns into a serpent. And then the Torah says that the Egyptian magicians duplicated that feat. So one of the questions of a commentator is, so if the Egyptians could duplicate the magical act, what was so great about it? And the answer is, there was Moses who could end that curse, but the Egyptians couldn't. In other words, it's very easy to bring a plague into the world. The challenge is, can you remove it from the world?
Ooh.
And listening to Mark Levine, there are many issues. And we can sit here and we can talk about all the problems confronting this city. But the challenge is, who's going to address them in a constructive fashion? Who's going to make a difference? So I like some of the responses that I heard, because at least it shows some insightful thinking.
He's thinking. He's thinking about his constituency. He's thinking about the borough. He's thinking about the city. And I love how hopeful he is, how upbeat he is. He's talking about, you know, tourist trade. He's talking about the fact that crime has gone down. And it's about coming up with the right strategy to address all these issues. So, yeah, look, we'll make him a borough president and get him reelected, right? I like his attention to understanding what's going on in the religious community with houses of worship, because I know for a fact that there were houses of worship in Harlem and other places who were exploited by developers because these clergy, you know, they're not development savvy, so they didn't know the value of air rights. I mean, you offer a pastor who's struggling, you know, a new church, a new sanctuary, whatever. Oh, really? That's fantastic. And all I have to do is give
just sign here.
Yeah. And all I have to do is surrender $200 million in air rights. Yeah. You could build me a $10 million church. And they walk away. In fact, Tish and I had talked about this, Tish James, the attorney general. And before her, when Schneiderman was there, you know, he and I worked together to address some of these issues. But it's good to know that he's on top of that.
The only thing that I find troubling is that we've heard the issues before. This is not the first time we're talking about homelessness. This is not the first time we're talking about housing. And at some point, people have to say, we've heard the problem, but when are we going to really make a significant difference in reducing the problem? So I would hope, and you know this, only if we get people working together, people on both sides. We have to look for that common ground, that common good. Otherwise, we're not going to see the kind of progress that we need to see to transform the climate.
You know, there is a passage in the New Testament where Jesus says, the poor you have with you always. And he was actually quoting it from the Hebrew scriptures, because the rest of that passage says, therefore, you have a responsibility to respond to the needs of those who are poor, those who are destitute. So, yeah, there's a reality that there will be individuals who are impoverished in our society. And we are a brother's keeper. What are we going to do about it? And I'm not talking about individuals who are just lazy, because there's just some people who are, you know, poor because they don't want to do anything. They don't want to work. They're not motivated. But I'm talking about people who are sincerely struggling. And you think about that. When I have seen early on, because I started ministry, man, I used to go down to the Bowery when the Bowery was filled with like shanty towns. This is in the 1970s, right? And you see how creative these individuals were, even though they were out on the streets homeless. And I met doctors who were out on the street homeless, but they put together a little shanty town. They'll gather, you know, boxes and pieces of wood and everything and create an order and organize safety and create a community at that time. So it's not that these individuals don't have a sense of life, don't have a sense of order and community. They do. It's thus that something has happened with them to put them in that position.
I was talking to an Orthodox young man, Orthodox Jew, who oversees an outreach program directly across the street from Columbia University. And he told me about the different components. You have people sleeping in the shelter. I think they use St. Luke's Church. People sleeping there. You have a life skills class where people are taught various skills. You have mental health professionals there. So it's a, you know, comprehensive approach, and they're making a difference. And I think one of the things we are seeing in a positive way is how houses of worship are very visible.
Yeah.
In terms of addressing these issues. When it came to the vaccine, how many sanctuaries became, you know, treatment centers? This is where I'm going to get my vaccine, at this church, at this synagogue. And how many homeless shelters, how many soup kitchens are housed or supported mm-hmm. by faith communities?
Mm-hmm.
So I think when we get everybody on the same page and saying, look, this is our problem. This homeless person may not be a member of my family, but he's a member of my immediate family.
Yep.
When we get people thinking that way, that the only way to solve this is if we engage as partners. And by the way, isn't that what the Bible teaches us? We're all partners in the story of creation. We're God's partners. We've heard that phrase, but we have to mean it. It can't be silent partners. You got to be active partners.
That's good. I like that. We can't be silent partners. And look, the causes. What are the causes of poverty? Personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
We have to put that
right
up front. When you have in a nation like this, where you have access and opportunity, you know, and yet you're still waiting for a handout. I got a problem with that. You know, fight. You know, our Constitution and our Declaration says what? We have the right to pursue happiness. It doesn't guarantee us happiness.
You got
to
pursue it.
You got to pursue it.
I remember my father would say to me, and I've heard this from other people who came to this country as immigrants, that there were those who said, look, the government will provide for you. And that was an insult. Provide for me?
Yeah.
I have to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't owe me. I owe it to myself and to my family.
That's right.
And that kind of thinking has to be in the forefront.
Yeah.
If we're going to see some change there. But that's one
yeah,
issue.
So personal responsibility. Yeah. And then you have the reality of natural forces. I mean, when you look at COVID, the devastation that COVID has brought to communities and families and businesses and houses of worship and all these entities, you know, across the country, people were wiped out. People were left where... We were started before pre-COVID. We were feeding about 25,000 to 30,000 people a year. COVID, we are now feeding 120,000 people in our food pantry, and we're seeing people who are coming who are middle class. It's not like they're poor.
I mentioned to you
and working class. These are middle class people.
One of the food programs in New York City, the director said to me, there were people in line getting food who were supporting our program. The donors became donees.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yeah.
And who would have thought that?
Yeah.
But there's also the story of overcoming it. And
well, let me give the third. You've got personal responsibility, you've got forces of nature, but you also have systemic issues where systems and structures are designed to either create or perpetuate conditions within the community and marginalizes people. And we've got to fight for that. We've got to fight through that. And we've got to address all three, because we can't just blame the poor for their poverty. We've got to look at the circumstances that created that. And if it's because they're not motivated, well, we need to challenge them and say, you need to get the, you know, hallelujah
say it,
off.
Say it.
You want me to say it? Get up off your hallelujah, right?
Yeah.
And take advantage of the opportunities that are available to you.
But you know, we go back to the Bible, that we are given. We are given free will. We are given this divine spark, created with a divine spark. We have the opportunity in many cases to overcome many of the challenges, but we have to be strong.
Yeah, we're given time.
Mm-hmm.
We each have a talent, a skill, an aptitude that's unique to us, right? We're given relationships that we get along the way. And it's all about how we manage our time, our relationships, our talent. Translate. And in America, that's the beauty of America. You can take that talent and translate it into value in the marketplace that can earn a living for
and
you.
And the first word you said was you. Right.
Yeah.
Look, there's a saying in Israel, we will because we must.
Hmm.
And I think people have to understand, you have to really want to. Sometimes you won't succeed, but at least you got to make the effort.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Well,
it's good
discussion. Great conversation that started with history and World War I, World War II, and, you know, how do we respond to situations like that? But I think something that you brought up importantly, and that is that we can't just whitewash history. We need the good, the bad, and the ugly. We need to know about it so we don't repeat these
things. Too many people have the abridged or truncated version of history. They only know one particular part, but not, as we said, the rest of the story.
Yeah, we need the rest of the story. And you get it right here on 77 WABC on The Reb and the Rabbi.
Smooth. Very smooth.
Until next week. We'll be back next time right here. God bless.